from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When government budgets get slashed, social programs often experience some of the sharpest cuts. So, in difficult times, what's the most efficient way to help struggling families? One model may be the Oakland-based Family Independence Initiative, which has helped families boost income and savings at a fraction of the costs of traditional social programs. The project is led by Maurice Lim Miller, who President Obama recently appointed to the White House Council for Community Solutions. We'll talk with Maurice Lim Miller as part of our First Person series, focusing on the leaders and innovators who are making a difference in the Bay Area. Maurice Lim Miller, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In 1999, Oakland Mayor Jerry Brown made a phone call to Maurice Lim Miller, then director of the well-regarded Oakland Community Service Organization, Asian Neighborhood Design. As Miller tells the story, Brown was fed up with anti-poverty programs that went about their business year after year, but never seemed to make much difference. "Isn't this just poverty pimping?" the mayor asked. By 2 years, Miller had launched something new, the Family Independence Initiative, a project that takes a radically different approach to helping families. The project gives families the freedom to design their own plan to move out of poverty and minimizes the role of professional staff. The results have been impressive, with enrolled families increasing both income and savings at a fraction of the cost of traditional social programs. Maurice Lim Miller emigrated from Mexico to the United States as a child, went on to earn 2 degrees from the University of California, Berkeley. And last year, President Obama appointed Miller to the White House Council for Community Solutions. He joins us now as part of our ongoing first-person interview series, where we focus on the leaders, innovators, and creative individuals who are making a difference in the Bay Area. Maurice Lim Miller, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
It's a pleasure to have you with us today. I want to go back to 1999, and even before we get that what sounds like a very typical phone call from then-Mayor Jerry Brown of Oakland, and ask you about something else that happened in 1999, which was an invitation you got to the State of the Union address by then-President Bill Clinton, who wanted to salute the work you were doing with Asian Neighborhood Design. What was your reaction to that? At that point, were you already wondering whether or not the more old style, if I could use that word, type of social program was working?
Yeah, I had gone into the nonprofit sector about 1978, 79. And about 10 years after I'd been doing my work, I was noticing that the first kids I had trained and helped get jobs were starting to show up in my program. And so my questioning started about mid-90s as to, well, I'm helping people, but how come it didn't fundamentally change things?
Because you were seeing a second generation sort of in the same circumstances?
And I knew the families. I knew that in many ways they were like my mother. It's like the families were trying to work. They worked very hard, but they couldn't keep all of their kids out of trouble. So maybe one of the kids would get in trouble and they'd fall back into the system. And I had to redo it. And so it really harkened back to how in my family, I'm the only one that really made it out. My mother continued to work really hard. My sister really got into with the wrong kids. There was a lot of trouble in that. That wasn't why I left engineering to do this kind of work. I wanted to see some fundamental change.
So
I was questioning it.
When you were sitting there at the State of the Union address, we've all seen that sort of iconic scene with the president addressing and he introduces or points to someone in the gallery. And that someone in this case was you. Were you already thinking, I really shouldn't be here? I really shouldn't be being saluted by the president of the United States?
Well, yeah, but it actually was before Congress. It was when I first got the call, I couldn't believe that I was actually being honored. So I'm already really questioning whether this is really working. And so I had mentioned that I turned him down when the first call came in. And the woman was a bit incredulous. She called me from the chief of staff's office.
You're saying no to who?
Yeah. Are you sure you don't want to come? And, after I hung up, I realized maybe I'd made a mistake. And what had happened was that I had already planned a trip to the Philippines to meet my father, because I was only raised by my mother, who was Mexican, and I had never met my father. And this was kind of an important point, but my ex pointed out that I could actually shift the plane ride and I could make the State of the Union address. So I did end up going. But through all that, yes, I was shaking hands with the president. He was, you know, congratulating me. And I'm over there, boy, if this is some of the best in the country, if we're considered one of the best in the country, I think our expectations are a little low.
So when Jerry Brown called you months later and said, I'm frustrated with what you all are doing in the anti-poverty field, you were ready to say, you bet?
Yeah. I mean, when he put out this whole thing of poverty pimping, I think last time I heard about it was from the Black Panthers in the 1960s. I was in Berkeley at the time. And they said, you're starting these poverty programs. The money should go to us, you know, and you guys are just going to create jobs for yourselves, right? So here's Jerry Brown bringing that up like 20, 30 years later. And no, I wasn't arguing that point. But what I did is I blamed him and money. I said, you know, too many regulations, not enough money. And he's over there, no, if you guys had ever come up with anything that worked, you wouldn't have all that stuff. And then he did a very typical thing. He just stopped the conversation. He said, look it. If you could do anything you wanted to do and you wanted to impact poverty, what would you do? And you come into my office next month and show me. And that ended the conversation.
Now, and you did?
Well, see, what was fascinating is that I'd never had an opportunity like that. Now, you know, growing up poor, you're always in a box. And I think people said I could push the box pretty well, but I was always in a box. And all of a sudden, this guy was telling me that there's no box. What would you do if there's no box? Right? And so I just thought, just for the hell of it, you know, it'd be fascinating to try. So for 2 weeks, I thought of everything I could and came to the conclusion I didn't know. You know, if I was all powerful, I didn't know how I was going to impact poverty. But I had to show up at his office. So he said, and so what I did know is that my mother got me out. So when I ended up at his office, he's like yelling orders to people walking through his office and what, and all of a sudden then he focuses on you for probably it's only going to be 3 minutes. And it's like, so how would you end poverty, right? And I'm over there, well, I don't know how I would do it. They said, but my mother knew how to do it for me. And I think every mother would know how to do it for their own kids. And dad's the same thing. So I'd take some of this money you complaining that we're just spending on creating jobs for ourselves. I ran a social service agency, 120 staff. I'd take some of that money and make it available to the families if they would show us what they would do.
So was that is that the fundamental flaw then in the way most typical social programs work, that the money goes to infrastructure, to well-meaning, well-trained, well-intended professional staff, creates all these big programs, but not enough lands with the people who need it most?
Yeah, but you have to make a distinction. You know, my sister would get beat up and she'd have to run away with, you know, from her husband with 3 kids. And the safety net was really important to her.
Yeah.
You know, she's in crisis. And when you have people in crisis, that's what the safety net was set up for. The dilemma ended up once she stabilized and like for my mother, once she was working, there's nothing for them, you know. And if anything, then there's a perverse incentive in the safety net. We take things away as long as if you keep working. So it isn't that I want to make that distinction that the safety net is actually really needed, but it is perverse unless there is another incentive type of system that recognizes initiative. So that is a fundamental problem. Fundamental problem isn't the safety net. The fundamental problem is that we don't have a benefit structure that really recognizes initiative unless you're rich.
So we need the safety net for the people like your sister who are in crisis, and you need staff and you need services,
right,
and you need money to provide for that situation. It sounds like you want to focus on the next step up, the person who is stabilized but doesn't have everything they need to sort of climb up the ladder.
Yeah, and it's like 97% of the folks that are low income. I think the Census Bureau did a study that released in 2008, and they studied people under the poverty level for 3 years, and they found that 97% of them actually got above the poverty level. The only way you do that is by working, right? But within 3 years, 30% were right back under, which is like my sister and, you know, that kids that I was seeing start going back. And so, you know, we spent a lot of money on the social service system, but without that other benefit system, then we can't actually break the cycle. So it isn't that I just want to focus on the ones that aren't in crisis. I want to focus on once the ones in crisis stabilize, that they have an opportunity to get out.
Maurice Lim-Miller is our guest. He is the founder and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative, which is a national center for anti-poverty innovation here in the Bay Area, now has branched out to do some work in Boston and the beginnings of a new project in New Orleans as well. So let's talk about your new model, the Family Independence Initiative. Once you got out of Jerry Brown's office, what did you, and I want to come back to this question of the mom factor, because it sounds like that's where you begin. That's your starting point.
Yeah, it really is. I'm sorry. There was one other thing that happened that was really parallel to this, was when I was questioning whether my services were making a difference, then I knew that my mother came to this country because it had a huge history of people getting out of poverty. I mean, that's why we came. And some other, well, how can this be that here we are focused on poverty and somehow or other we don't seem to be impacting? And I knew the figures, right? And yet there was this huge – so I started studying how people had gotten out of poverty, whether it was the Polish, the Irish, and whatever. And what I found was that there were some very common elements, which is people had to work together. You know, it was a community sense, and they shared. And that once somebody succeeded, which now in the terminology is like positive deviance, that they would share that knowledge and they would pool their money. And so you had Polish going into meat factories, or you had the Irish going into construction, or you had, you know, and the more recent examples, Cambodians owning, you know, 90% of the donut shops in California. Right? So it wasn't that it had disappeared, but for some reason we'd forgotten that this country has a huge history of how people get out of poverty. And so that, I had already been studying that when Jerry Brown kind of gave the call. So the other thing I told him is not just about moms doing it themselves, because, you know, it's too hard to do it by themselves. Nobody really gets out just by themselves. So I told him what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to go back to the historic model. I'm only going to bring in groups of families that are peers, that are friends. They already have some sense of community that'll share. And when I enroll them, I'm going to challenge them to do what you said we're not doing as professionals.
So walk us through the model then. You begin with families, and not just one family. It's got to be a half a dozen families so that you have that built-in historical kind of model for how people can kind of work together and stay together.
Right. And then we essentially tell them, it's like, look, Jerry Brown called me up, and he wants to know how you would do it. You know, I think you need each other, because you're going to need each other, because my staff is not allowed to give you any direction. We're not here. We're here to learn from you. Smartest people with a lot of money have tried for 30 – at that point, it was 30 years, right? Now it's been 40 years of the war on poverty. They've really tried to figure out how to help you. Now it's your turn, and we are going to learn from you. And that challenge is really important. The other thing is that you can earn some money as long as I don't have to hire staff. You have to do all the work. I'll pay you – actually, they get paid less than I'd have to pay when I hire a social worker. But we'll pay you to really replace staff.
So let's back up one step. You have a relatively small budget, $2 million, as I understand it. You have a gargantuan staff of five, right?
Nationally.
Yeah. So the money doesn't go to big staff, big offices, big infrastructure. You bring in these families and you give them certain incentives where they can make some money instead of staff making money. Describe what those are and how that works.
Well, what it really came out of is that I was an engineer and I like data and I like clean data. So I actually, when I was with Asian Era Design, I had already developed a tracking system. I want to know what is going on in people's in families' lives. What are the kids doing? And what are you doing every month? And so I developed a data tracking system back in the 90s that essentially we were going to use to track what families do and how they get their lives together. That's what I told Jerry is we're going to do. We're going to learn from them. And so every family gets given a computer, and then the data tracking system is online. So they go online every month. And when they go online, they have to report to us, has your income changed? Has your kids' grades changed? Have your savings changed? You know, did you help somebody? Did somebody help you? Those kind of things. And then what, in order to get them to report, though, I knew I had to incentivize somehow. So I didn't want to incentivize the particular action because I wanted to learn. So what we do is we pay a pretty minimal amount for each action they report that I can audit. So if they get a new job, I want to see payroll stubs. If their savings go up, I want to see the savings form. And, you know, if the kids' grades go up, we see report cards and stuff like that. And that was going to take their time. Now, normally, I had to hire consultants to get all of that data, which cost me like $100 an hour. So in this particular case, then they get $30 for each positive action, but it's capped so that they have to look at their entire life in order to earn as much as possible.
So let's say one of your family says, okay, this month I got a new job. My son Sam's grades went up a bump, and we just got health insurance.
Right.
So we've
that's
what we accomplished. So it's bonus money essentially. I mean, it's not enough to it's not like income. It's something that incentivizes that sort of action.
It incentivizes the reporting of the action. In other words, if I told them—
Not sure I get the distinction.
Oh, okay. So if I told them, we'll pay you $5 if you report these things, they're not going to pay much attention to it.
Right.
If I told them, I'll give you $100 for things, then it's like they're going to pay a lot of attention to it.
Yeah.
So $30, it was $25 to $30. It's like, well, it doesn't incentivize me to do that, but it incentivizes me to go on this online tracking system and report it. And that's what we wanted. We wanted the reporting. So we pay them for the amount of time and to pay attention to reporting so we can learn.
So at most, the families who participate in the family independence initiative are going to make maybe a couple $1,000s a year. Is that right?
At the most. The average is about $1,600 a year.
And so what does that accomplish? I mean, this is really fascinating to me. For a fairly small investment, what are you seeing that people then do?
Oh, in terms of what they do, it's like Boston probably is the most amazing example because now it's starting. I think things are happening faster than even in San Francisco. What they get all of a sudden is that it is possible to change your life.
Yeah.
Essentially, we don't go with families that are already changing their life. Okay, it's like, no, we're not going to learn a lot from that. They already have. So it's most families that have kind of given up and they're just trying to survive. All of a sudden, when there's this group of people that they're surrounded, which are friends, but normally they only talk with their friends in terms of crisis, can I use your couch? Now, all of a sudden, everybody's trying to do something positive because they're going to teach us.
And that's mutually reinforcing?
Oh, it's hugely reinforcing. It's like how you and I, when we raise our kids, what we want to do is we surround ourselves with friends that have the same values, that similar, and that kind of drives our kids, drives us because you're in this network. All of a sudden, they have a network that's thinking about the positive, the need stuff.
Is there also then not only mutually reinforcing, is there a kind of accountability built into that so that oh my goodness, the Jones family down the street here is just reporting X and Y. I better be on the job too?
It is every human instinct. It's like there's sometimes a little jealousy, envy. There's accountability. There's like, how come you're not doing that? You know, or I'll help you. You know, so it's the same thing as with friends. It's like all of those things come into play, which you can't do with professionals.
How long does someone, if we have, we go back to our, you've enrolled six families who all know each other. They work through this system that you're describing, they're building their lives, they're getting some additional reward for that. How long does that last? Is that capped? Do you stay then as part of the program for 2 years and then you're done?
Well, in terms of are they done, in terms of meeting with us to get stories and whatever, yes, after about 2 years, you're done in terms of, you know, interacting with us. In terms of their lives, no. They continue their lives. It's like, but once they're on a track of things being positive, they really push for continuing that. So we went back into Oakland, the Oakland project that Jerry helped me start. And after the third year, income had gone from already it was 27% above baseline after 2 years. By the third year, it was 40% above baseline.
Let me give some of the numbers from your projects. Income on average goes up over 20%. Savings go up over 200%. 30% of your families have started new businesses, and 70% of the kids have gotten better grades. And that continues, Maurice Lynn Miller, beyond the time that they're a part of the program. So it's not something that, again, going back to your original point where people have a tendency to kind of fall back into hard times, what you're discovering is that falling off phenomenon doesn't occur?
I can't say that universally, you know, because those are all averages.
Yeah.
So we have families that don't do that well. But on average, yes, everybody starts doing much better. And so if you start looking at this at scale, then we can impact poverty. Are we going to end poverty? I don't think that's what we're trying to do. But can we impact poverty? Yeah, I think we can. We could. And it's not just impacting poverty. The problem in the country right now is we're losing our middle class. You know, my mother got me into middle class, and that's what this project's about. It's like taking people like my sister, once they stabilized, which was under poverty, and moving them all the way to independence. We can't just leave them as working poor.
Maurice Lynn Miller, again, our guest. He is the founder and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative. What are you learning? You said before that this started out as being something where you wanted to learn from these families. What have you learned?
I think my biggest lesson is that, you know, your mother is your mother and your mother's special. And I think what I learned is that there's a lot of really special people out there and that, you know, what I thought I didn't think we'd get this kind of return. You know, I thought they'd do better, you know, because they own the thing. But how these families have done have been really, you know, amazing. And they're productive. They help this country. It was really the kind of thing that if my mother had gotten a little bit of assistance and recognition of her initiative, her talent, she was. You know, she only had a third grade education, but she was talented. And if there had been some recognition and just a little bit of assistance, she could still be alive.
If you had to summarize what sort of both what you've learned, but also the key principles in all of this, what would it be? Is it get out of the way, social programs and staffers? Is it pay attention? Is it just help people a little? What are the kind of key points that you've discerned from this process?
I want to come back to the professional role.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I feel like, what are the key elements? One is that you have to honor initiative. You have to recognize that in low-income communities, they're not lazy. You know, that really is a lot that they do. And you have to recognize that. And you have to give them credit for the fact that they work actually really hard cleaning our yards and everything else. The second piece is that they do need each other. You know, and you need friends, and this country tends to disaggregate people into individuals. We need to build this sense of community again. And the last thing is we need to listen to them. You know, and this goes back to the role of services, because you need services. You and I don't know about you and your family, but my kids needed mentors and they needed schools and they needed all these things. What was interesting is because when I was middle income, I had money. I could drive the services, right? They tried to please me. They were always trying to fill in market niches. It doesn't work that way for low-income folks. We have fragmented services that are designed by the top. And then they're trying to be provided if you meet my whatever. So it isn't consumer driven. So the services are needed and the professionals are needed, but they need to be driven by the consumer. And right now we think of the consumers as victims, or sometimes people think of them as lazy or don't have the capacity. And what I've learned, you asked me what's the biggest thing, you know, is people know how. They know themselves. They know their capacities and they can work their way through, and you have to give them some space to do that.
How far can this grow? It's relatively small number of families that you've worked with so far, 100 or so, is that right?
It's 300.
300, okay, sorry.
Or a little more, but
can you scale it up? I mean,
For us, it's been funding. You know, we do not fit into anybody's funding silos. We're not a housing program. We're an economic development program.
Yeah, so where does the money come from? Where does that $2 million come from?
It's a lot of high net worth individuals. Business people tend to get our models, because business people invest in the best ideas and they know those are the ones that will scale. And that's the way it works, which is that when we opened up nominations in San Francisco, we only had 16 households we started.
Nominations, you mean?
For them to bring in other families in.
Okay.
Within 6 months, 200 families were clamoring to get in.
Yeah.
Word of mouth, just word of mouth. We had no advertising. And they, you know, the families that the 16 families had to do the orientations, whatever, we're not hiring staff, right? And then it's gone to 300 and you know, that type of scaling. In Boston, same thing. We opened up nominations again and we have, you know, 100 families already showing up.
We have to go to break, so I'm going to hold this question. But I'm curious when we come back to talk about how you pick families. If you have more demand than you can provide, what are the elements that you're looking for in those families that will make or break? Because I'm sure in a sense you're placing your bets. You're trying to figure out who it is that will have the best opportunities. We'll come back. Now that I've asked a long question, we'll get a good answer when we return. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation. If you're someone who is interested in this sort of program, is in need of this kind of program, wants to fund this kind of program, any of those things, we'll take your call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your question or comment there for Maurice Lim Miller, the founder and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative. More with Maurice Lim Miller in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Maurice Lim Miller, as part of our ongoing first-person interview series where we try to talk to people who are making a difference in the Bay Area. His project is doing just that. It's the Family Independence Initiative. Before the break, I was starting to pose a question to you about how you identify these families. You have lots of families who want to get in on your project. How do you go about selecting them? Are you saying, I think they'd be a good bet. Let's go with them. What is it that draws you, I guess, to a particular sort of constellation of families? Because again, it's you want a group of six families or so together.
Yeah, the thing that I realized that my mother faced was a lot of the stereotypes. She would say, I'm Mexican, so they think I'm lazy, and I'm a woman, so they don't think I can do stuff and whatever. And it became really clear to me that the stereotype was really the biggest hampering in terms of making benefits and help available to my mother or other families. And so what we're trying to do is actually find families that not the immigrant hopeful, not the ones that are making it and whatever. In Hawaii, we turned down a whole group that you could tell they were going to do really well with just a little bit of extra help. And so we're trying to look at the communities that have become isolated. And so it was really trying to get a diversity of them, because I also felt this is a human quality. Trusting one another is a human quality. And so I had to deal with the race issues. We had to have African Americans, we had to have Latinos, we had to have Asians. But then I didn't want the immigrants, so we had refugees and stuff. So really,
why not immigrants?
Because everybody has the thing of, well, they're going to make it anyway. That doesn't prove anything. What we were trying to do is prove a point that the capacity was there, that if our country invested in people we keep thinking or don't work hard and whatever, that actually we could get a lot out of it. So I needed to test that. And remember, this was a challenge by Jerry Brown. And the whole thing was to me to really prove what is the capacity. And I didn't expect this much progress.
So interesting. So your starting point was you had to be at least second generation in this country because you felt like the odds were good for people who were just arriving?
No, you had to have kind of lost hope. That you'd kind of given up and you're just going to survive. Not in crisis. So we wouldn't take people in crisis. That's what the safety net is for. But you really were feeling like, no, I can't make it in this country. Either have to go back to El Salvador or, I've been on welfare and my kids are shooting each other, which is what was happening with a lot of the men, the Asian community and stuff. So we were looking at those communities that really fall into our service system a whole lot. Those were the ones I'd see in my programs. I wanted to deal with the same population I dealt with in my social services to see how they would do if they had a chance.
I want to go back, if I might, because I think this is a really interesting point about how you kind of arrived at the direction that you now have. One article I read about you said that at one point when you were thinking about, I just don't know if this is working, back in your sort of old social services model days, that you thought about starting a dating service. And I read that and I chuckled, just as you are now. But then I sort of got it, because part of what you've come to is this feeling that relationships and family count. That's what moves people forward, not just their next appointment with their social worker.
It's really interesting you got to that, because that was probably like 1979 and 1980 maybe. I was training gang kids because they wanted to get out. People really do want to have better lives, right? And I remember this one kid, and he was a pain, and he was extremely difficult. I didn't think anything. I was training him. You could get him a job and whatever. And he wasn't getting anywhere. And all of a sudden, he met this young woman. And his life, like, totally stabilized, right? He had a kid. They're going to name it after me. It was really bizarre. I was like, no, don't name him Maurice. But anyway, so watching that relationship, or watching a kid when he goes back to his parents and they respect each other, that those were transformative. And for me, it was that same thing. So relationships, those personal relationships were really important. But later I told you what I learned is that it's not just the personal relationship. It's your social network. And when I became middle income, I learned that middle and upper income use social networks. That's their primary way that they get anything done.
So there is really, in a sense, a direct connection, because if you are able to forge a good relationship, what starts as a dating relationship, that means that you found someone who believes in you and you believe in them. And that builds out from there to a general sense of belief and possibility.
There is so much that you get when somebody believes in you. And in many ways, FI plays that role. We have this validation of, we know you know the best way. There's no way I can bring a case manager that wouldn't know you. And that validation is huge for folks.
Let's hear what some of our listeners think of this. We're going to start with Ken in Concord. Ken, go ahead, please.
Hi. I've seen it from both sides, both being on welfare as a family and having been an apartment manager in a very bad neighborhood of San Francisco. right in the middle of four projects. I just want to say this is wonderful to hear that somebody's got themselves on track of breaking the pattern, I guess I'd say, because the existing pattern of welfare is crushing, it's disrespectful, and disincentives are built into everything. So I'm really glad to hear somebody's trying a different way, because even as a white kid raised in the middle class, I found myself totally disrespected when I had to apply for welfare. I couldn't work, or they'd take away the welfare, and I couldn't afford that because I had three kids. So I was incentivized to do nothing.
Hmm. Ken, thank you.
So thank you very much for putting this person on the air, and I hope this program expands widely, because the current welfare system is absolutely broken and taking people who would otherwise like to do well and crushing them.
Ken, thanks for the call and the observation.
No, I would totally agree. It's unless we establish another system for people to get help, and we do help people that have money, we have incentives for them, whatever, unless we establish something for working poor, then it becomes very crushing. It really should be a safety net, and it should be seen as a positive thing, but a very temporary piece. But it can't be temporary unless you have some other system that actually can help you move forward.
There's also a cost factor. I said at the beginning of the program that, you know, in these difficult budgetary times where social programs are getting whacked right and left, many, many good programs are under the budget knife. One of the things, just from a pure business standpoint, we should mention is that your program's a good deal. I mean, you're spending less per family, way less than typically social programs do.
Yeah, when I ran my social services, I would spend anywhere from $8,000 to $12,000. This was back in the 90s. $8,000 to $12,000 to train one individual to try to get them to get a job and hopefully retain that job for a year. So this costs like $500 a year for 2 years for an individual.
And to more of our calls, Joan in Sacramento joins us next. Joan, go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air, Joan.
Oh, hello. First of all, I'm just very excited about what you've been doing. I come from a social service background initially and can really appreciate your comments. My question is, what has been your experience in working with African Americans? And I raise this issue because historically all the indices put us at the lowest end of the barrel in terms of poverty pretty consistently. And I'm wondering what you've learned about African-Americans in your program who've been successful that could speak to some of the hardcore problems we've experienced or in trying to work with this group and get them out of poverty. I'm particularly aware of those people who are working full-time but are still in the poverty level because of low wages.
Well, I think what we've all kind of known is that I think African-Americans face the greatest barriers, whether it's racism or, you know, opportunity, lack of opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. But what was really interesting is if you take away that mentality of, oh, you know, there's all of these other things that the African-Americans have to face, and you just – when we approached all the groups of, like, we're going to learn from you, in Oakland, the African-American groups were the ones that did the best on all the quantitative issues, their income, their assets, their savings. The Asians did the worst, you know, and so it's like – it depends, you know. And the thing is that what we need to do is really kind of put the stereotypes aside and make opportunities available and let people rise as far as they can. And what you're going to find is that you're going to find people rising that are African-American, people rising that are Latino, then whatever. And once you start seeing that of somebody you can relate to, then that starts raising all boats because it starts changing expectations in the broader community. So even if a community has been really oppressed, the issue is recognize those that are moving up and then facilitate the other ones to follow. And I found that in any ethnicity.
Is there a common denominator for those who move forward the quickest and in the most ongoing kind of way? And conversely, is there a common denominator for those who don't?
Okay, I can give you my opinion. And to be honest with you, I don't know this very well. I think the common denominator is the strength of your social networks and your sense of community, that especially if you can get it, that community into a positive orientation, that there's so much reinforcement that happens from that. And people are dying to get that into that kind of – that's why we had 300 families, you know, applying to get in. They want to be in that kind of situation.
And by social networks, you mean the old-fashioned social networks,
not
Facebook social networks.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think technology can help us a whole lot. We actually are developing social media. We have this Yelp piece that's going on and whatever because at this point in time – I think the media and that social – that type of networking can actually be a huge help and actually can be some of the leveling playing field around the class issues and class separations that are happening.
So how does that – whether it's old-fashioned kind of neighborhood-based social connections or using technology, what is it that's going on there or the lack of it that's not going on with others that tips it?
It's funny. We have an evaluator that, you know, has been evaluating our projects and our data and stuff like that. But the other thing is that they've noticed is that a lot of what we're experiencing is kind of backed by behavioral studies. And so it is these human qualities that are really important. I feel like what we're doing is still learning what it is, and I would say it's more these issues of trust and opportunities that lie in these social networks.
Joan, is that getting to your question about African-American communities in particular? Anything else you want to follow up with Maurice Lynn Miller?
Yeah, I'd just like to ask him, what would he tell President Obama to do if he asked you what could he do to improve poverty?
Well, he has that opportunity because he's been appointed by President Obama to the White House Council for Community Solutions.
Right.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. You want me to ask? Actually, you know, if anybody who's been president has this, is that I think President Obama and Michelle Obama have a sense of what family and how family is important. And he should claim that. He should claim that as his issue, that what we need to do is turn back to these families and let them do what they have the potential to do, which is what we're trying to prove, is they have huge potential. And we don't have a lot of money. And so I think we do need to go back to people and their communities.
You know, it's so interesting, I think, that you would say that because we were talking in the break about what a bitterly partisan, divisive time that we live in and the lack of sort of common civility that takes place. And we see that so much in our political dialogue right now. The one thing you always hear, though, people say, even those who are bitterly critical of President Obama, he's got a nice family. You know, I like the way he is with his daughters. I like what's going on with them.
Right.
It's a source of strength in the end, probably for all of us, that he probably needs as much as anyone these days. Let's hear next from Sylvia in Oakland. Sylvia, go ahead, please.
Yes, Mr. Miller, you mentioned the need for another system besides the welfare system. I'm wondering what you see as policy implications for your program, and I'll take my answer off there.
Sylvia, thanks.
Okay, that's a hard one. Not totally hard, but because policy isn't, I think, going to be the biggest driver. I do think that the attitudes that we have towards people that are low income are the biggest hampering piece. And that, again, when we talk about whether the president could really start changing those attitudes and show how productive people can be, that I think would have the biggest, impact. But policies also send a message. And policies that are very top-down and very regulated and don't have the flexibility to create family actually can start replacing family and community. And so I would change a lot of the policies. One of the things is that, Governor Brown's staff did meet with me recently. Head of Social Services were there. And
so you're still getting phone calls from Jerry Brown.
Yeah, and at dinner time still. So after he became governor, he did call me again, and he's kept track of what we're doing, and I always thank him. One of the things that we're saying is that people need one another, and that in many ways we want to talk to them about replacing case managers, which we're losing anyway. We can't pay them, and replace those with peers, people that have already succeeded in the areas that they're interested in, and so people can help one another. And it's not going to cost you anywhere near as much because people love helping one another.
When people say things, Sylvia's question makes me think about another phrase that often bubbles up in these conversations, which is we have to get at the structural causes of poverty. Do you believe in that, that there are structural causes? Or in the end, is it really more about this, these more personal familial ingredients?
There definitely are structural causes, you know, and structural pieces, you know, whether you call it institutional racism, whatever these things, it plays into people's lives. And what's interesting, though, is if you go back to the Irish and the Polish, and there was a lot of discrimination. There were a lot of structural barriers. You could see that people, however, if they really group together and they work one another, they can still accomplish a lot. But we are in a different time now. I think we're in a time when actually we could make much more progress because we've at least, you know, through law and stuff, we've gotten rid of some of that. So on the one hand, I think people still need one another. But I think actually the biggest structural barrier is that because we don't see that population as productive, we don't invest in them. Mm-hmm. If you're a Stanford graduate student and you have an idea, you have angel investors looking to give you $1 million. There is no such structure. You know, business does not actually recognize the kind of – one of the things I wanted to mention is that out of 160 households that we have in San Francisco, 30% of them have started businesses. This is how they're surviving. They've created 80 jobs, but there's no investment system. There is no structural piece that will invest in them. If they graduated from Stanford, there would be, but they haven't. And so you need to have – it's not micro loans. It's really, really micro type of loans. Those types of things need to be. Those are structural pieces. We need to look at what works for middle and upper income and make those available to low income.
Do you mean things like Kiva and those sorts of organizations where you can go online and say, Mary Smith is creating this business in her neighborhood and she needs $5,000. Would you like to invest in Mary's business? That sort of small scale?
That scale, but it doesn't have to be just Kiva. Those are things that I think, you know, the Small Business Administration could change the way it works. Department of Commerce could change the way it works. Foundations could change the way they work.
And back to our calls. Don joins us next in Sonoma. Don, go ahead, please.
I want to thank Maurice Lynn Miller for the work he's doing. And I want to also say, do not think that you are isolated because people like Frankel in logotherapy, Miller and Rolnick in motivational interviewing, Bapuji in nonviolent organization have done things similar. And the important thing to do is to continue to say, I have to oppose top-down instruction, that the institution does not know what is best for the client. The client knows the truth. The client will find, if he's helped or if she's helped, a motive, a motivation. And thank you for helping people do that.
Don, thank you. It's an interesting point, and in some ways probably is as big an obstacle, I suspect, sometimes to climb over as any. Don's point that the client knows the direction. Do you have a hard time getting your staff to believe that always, to say, back off? Your job is to listen, not to provide solutions.
Yeah, I've had a number of situations. I remember one of the first program managers that I was working with came to me one time and said, you know, the group I'm working with, they're not doing enough. And, you know, I'm getting frustrated with them. And so what should I do? And I'm over there. I looked at her and it's like, you know, you don't trust them. You don't trust that they're going to do something. And all I had to do was that, and all this is realization that she had internalized that stereotype that, you know, they're supposed to do it the way she thinks. And she backed off and, you know, all of a sudden they start doing wonderful things. But you had to give them space.
Don, thanks for the call. Still time to join us. If you'd like to pose a question or an observation to Maurice Lynn Miller, you can do so at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comment there. Charles in Oakland is next. Charles, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I guess my question was this. This all sounds wonderful, and I do praise you for it. I guess one question I have is, it seems the key to all this, as has been pointed out, is your social network, whether it be family, friends, associates, etc. Lacking that, what would be your recommendation, or how can this program help, or what would be the perspective if a family was so destitute they didn't have a network?
Yeah, fair question, Charles. Thank you.
You know,
I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay, Charles. Thanks.
Sure. One of the things is that I do think the safety net is important. There are programs that can both help you stabilize and then start to rebuild that sense of confidence to start forming friendships and social networks. And sometimes when people have gone through a lot of trauma, that they do need some help in doing that. But ultimately, the solution is that you're going to have to, you know, have friends. You're going to have to go talk to your cousin. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to. And, you know, family can be a pain in the butt, but family is family. And, you know, everybody's had parents. Everybody's had cousins or friends. And that rebuilding of those relationships is what, you know, Child Protective Services is learning, what foster programs are learning, is that one of the best solutions is to go back and really get those ties to start working again.
And to underline Charles's point, though, you're not saying that the Family Independence Initiative is the be-all and end-all solution for all possible social problems. You're taking one really important chunk of this, but there are other chunks that have to be contended with as well.
Yeah, there really are. We're not the safety net. You know, for sure, we're not the safety net. The safety net has to be based on need. You know, the more trouble you're in, you have to assess that, and then you have to be able to stop that crisis. So that's the way the safety. For us, we're trying to assess initiative. Totally different staff. You cannot work the same staff to try to do what we do. The due diligence, everything is you have to think of families very differently and leave that stereotype behind. So ours is more about creating that other system. FII is to show that there can be a different system to help people, that people can jump from welfare into this system that really is available for people that have money.
And again, FII is the Family Independence Initiative. Maurice Lynn Miller, the founder and CEO. Let's take one more call. Charlie in San Francisco. Charlie, go ahead.
Hi. I read this great book called A People's History of Poverty in America, and it talks extensively about our history of ineffective social work, including at the beginning of the industrial age, some rich ladies getting together to give flowers to starving children. And I just wanted to also maybe see if you could talk a little bit about childcare, and even lower middle class people need good childcare so that they can have opportunities to work. And I feel like an issue that most people can identify with as being like, well, if your child isn't being well taken care of, you're not going to go work for 40 hours.
Yep, Charlie, thank you. And I can hear that you're contending with that question as we speak. Thanks for the call.
You know, one of the things that and one of the reasons we're collecting so much data, and we need to get more families enrolled to get the diversity of what people's problems and needs and initiatives are, is that there is such a variety in other words, there's no single solution. And what I feel needs to happen is that you and other folks, when they're having to deal, you need a variety of choices. You know, it could be that you want to have relatives be able to take care of your kids. It could be that you want a nanny from the outside. It could be, and some of this is really hampered because you may not be able to earn enough. And so, you know, there's obviously systems in Europe that can provide you some backstop for some of this. So it isn't that the society can't provide that. But I think one of the biggest things that we're trying to push is that control needs to be given back to you or the family, and that you need to be provided with choices. So that's what middle and upper income have. They have a whole series of choices that they choose from.
Interested in getting your reaction to this next email from Guy, who writes in, I love this story. I see this as a very American way to make progress with social change. We don't need bigger government. We don't need to eliminate public support for overcoming social challenges. We just need to be a lot more innovative and smarter in solving the problems. I'm not sure if Guy is going here, but let me take his email to jump into something else, which is I can imagine a lot of people coming to you who would say, this is terrific. We can get rid of a whole bunch of social programs because Maurice Lynn Miller has come up with a way that's going to be a whole lot less expensive.
Well, you know, as long as you don't eliminate to the point that my sister couldn't have gotten help. You know, the fact is that it does take resources to be able to help people stabilize. And it does take, you know, what the other caller brought up is sometimes you need a little help to start rebuilding your community, your friends and your family and those relationships. So that still needs to happen. It's that we don't have then a continuous system that really takes you from all the way being under poverty level to really be more middle and upper income. And I think most middle income folks will tell you that this country does very little for them. And you wonder why we're losing ability. This, my issue is not just about poverty. Mm-hmm. My issue is that we're sort of losing this rising class. You know, we just don't have that anymore. It isn't the land of opportunity. It's now become the land of just try to survive. And that's what we don't want, because a very small investment, we're showing a very small investment gets you really big returns.
And there has to be, though, to place that investment. What you're also saying is that we need each other. We need, as corny as that sounds, we need each other. We need our families, and we need the neighbor next door.
Okay, so two of the things, the outside things you need is, yeah, you need other people. The other piece is that you do need some investment. I'm not saying that these folks don't need some resources. They do. They're living paycheck to paycheck. And so we need to invest based on their initiative, though. And we don't have that. We have a needs-based system right now. And if you only have a needs-based system, it becomes very perverse. But if you have an incentive system, which we – again, it's not like we don't have experience. We have ways that we help upper middle and upper income folks. We need to take those systems and really make them available to lower income.
Maurice Lynn Miller, again, the founder and CEO of the Family Independence Initiative. Just have a moment left. What's next for you? Still want to start that dating service? What's on the horizon?
Well, you know, it's funny. I have stopped trying to come up with solutions. It's sort of like even this question on childcare. It's like, you know, it's up to you, and you need to be given the purview to do that. And you don't want Maurice Lynn Miller trying to figure out solutions for you. So no, I'm not trying to do that anymore. I do want to surface this. I want families to really take it up. If we're shifting the responsibility back to families, they have to self-organize. They have to push for themselves. It's not going to be up to me. So this is really going to be much more of the families themselves have to recognize they do have that capacity. They need to really push for the change.
Maurice Lynn Miller, thanks for being with us this morning. Really a pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. Scott Schaefer will be filling in for Michael Krasny next week. Scott's topic on Monday morning will be the Burning Man Festival. Join Scott for that Monday morning on Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.